Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting, as always, from the Chicago suburbs, and I'm glad that you've joined me today at republicbroadcasting.org for people who can handle the truth or not. Sometimes we have a lot of very interesting things that we talk about. Today, you're going to love today's guest. Let me just say that. You're just going to love him. I hope that you will visit SpingolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. And as always, if you wish to ask questions or make comments during the program, email comment at Spingola.email. I also invite you to visit the chat room at spingola.chatango.com. And you know where the archives are. You know where you can see the reports of earlier guests, and as well as, for the last 10 years. You can see who I've had on the program. You can see who I'm going to have on in the future. And you can do that by looking at Spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button, and just enjoy what's there. There's a lot of resources there. We will take calls in the third hour at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Angelo John Gage. His website is angelojohngage.com. He is the author of a new book titled From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. It's a really interesting book. Oh my gosh. It's just a fabulous book. You really need to read this book. It's just a really great book. And I just want to read something before we bring Angelo on. Because on page 49 he says, many people, despite their level of intelligence, fail to understand the power of the pause and just ramble on, chaining their statements together with ums and uhs and other filler words. The ums in between your words is your brain trying to think of what to say next. But using fillers is not the best speaking strategy. Pausing not only allows you to think before you speak, it does this in a better way, allowing you to connect your words in a more fluid fashion. A well-timed pause can also emphasize any point you're trying to make much more profoundly, which is why you're speaking in the first place. One way I trained myself to master the pause was to replace all the ums and the like with pauses. Anytime I felt an coming on, I would just stop talking. It's quite easy, actually, but requires practice. A good exercise is to pretend that I'm on some kind of talk show doing an interview, which is what we're going to be doing. I imagine the interviewer viewer asking me questions about whatever subject, and I respond to each out loud as if I were there. Sound crazy? Well, yes, perhaps around other people, which is why I do it while driving or when I'm home alone. But it's very effective, like an actor practicing his lines. Okay, so that's a good introduction to our guest today, Angelo John Gage. Welcome to the program, Angelo. And this is one of those radio interviews that you referred to. I have this little note. It's on my monitor. It says, do not say, I mean, sure, you know, or So,
you can say, I mean, no, there's words you can say. Just, it's better. The ums are what people say a lot. You see it all the time. Right. A very intelligent person just, and they're just thinking. I just stopped doing it. I just didn't know. But your brain has to think, you're improvising especially, but when you just pause and just let your brain do its thing, you don't have to use any of those filler words, and it just makes everything. And when you see the best speakers, they don't use any of those words. But a lot of them are going off the script. You know, if you see a presidential candidate or something, or some professional on the stage. But I started practicing in my own mind, like I mentioned in the book, in my living room, in my car. So thank God there's Bluetooth now. People don't think you're crazy when they look in the window. You're just talking to yourself, or they think you're on the phone. But I've always talked to myself like this, and I always thought it was nuts. If my wife walks in, I'm like, huh, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just practicing. You know, she knows. But for me, it's something that you have to do if you want to get better. I mean, when I first made my when I went on YouTube years ago, I made my first video ever. And I like to do things from the heart. I don't like scripts. I can't even do scripts. I'll mess up the script. I'll skip a word. I'm just terrible at it. So everything's improvised. And my first video on YouTube was so terrible. It went viral, though. That's what got me on the map because of the topic. But it was so bad. I looked at it, oh, my God, I can't believe how horrible this video is. So over the years, you just keep doing them, and then you get better and better and better and better. And it's because I would practice. And as I mentioned also in the book, as you read it, I pretend to be on interviews. I pretend to be attacked by someone like, oh, well, your argument is bad. Here's why. And I refute the argument. And I think like the person interviewing me, it's a fun exercise to do. And you will get better at public speaking. You will get better on interviews. Everything will improve because you're training yourself to do it. Instead of doing it live with someone and being afraid and scared, you've already done it live in your head thousands of times, you know, in the comfort of your own home, you know, or your car or shower, wherever you want to do it. It is silly, but it's not, because an actor, they have to practice. They get the script. They're in their own house. They're practicing their scenes. If you walk in on that, that looks silly too, but there's the context. Well, I'm practicing my scene. For me, I'm making myself a better person to speak publicly, to do an interview or whatever else I want to do, make a video. And that's why my videos, when I do them on YouTube, they flow without any script. They just flow. And people, they know it's genuine because there's no script. You know, when you watch these politicians or somebody reading off a teleprompter, it's not genuine. There's nothing there, but they're reading someone else wrote. When I do a video and others like me who do improvisational things, it just comes out from the heart. And things will pause because you have to, as you improvise, you have to pause more because you have to think of what to say next. So, but you have to practice that. You have to really try and catch yourself. Oh, I just said How many did I do? 7? Okay, I'm not trying to do anything. And just stop, you know, just wait a minute. It's, you know, and that makes the message more powerful, and people feel it deeply. And plus, there's an element of suspense. And there's ways to, and I mentioned it too in that entry, that people use it to make a point, you know, and they do it all the time. A really good speaker does that. So I just learned it over time. I did NLP, as I mentioned in the book. I went to New York City and did a 2-year course on NLP, and there's a lot of stuff with how to speak to people. But I just learned a lot from people doing public speaking. And look, there's different kinds of people. There's like Tony Robbins, who's super fast.
Oh, you know, yes.
Blah, 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 and he does great. Then there's people who are very slow. You know, you got to find your own natural flow. And it also depends on your mood that day. There are times I rant if I, you know, if I make a video, I rant and everyone loves the rants more than everything. Then there's times I'm really, really calm and stoic like. You know, I used to do a lot of cursing. I stopped doing that. You know, not like I don't curse anymore, but I realized, you know, cursing in certain contexts works, but also can limit your message, you know, to a younger audience.
Yes.
There's a lot to go with that. But again, I just, you know, I was a Marine, and when I got a boot camp, everything was an F-bomb. Everything. Everything I said was F, just came out because it was just the way we were in the barracks and stuff. And I had to stop curse. I remember I was in a restaurant and I was dropping F-bombs and people were looking at me. I'm like, oh wow, I got to stop because I'm no longer in the Marine Corps. I had to have to deprogram myself from being like that. Cause all you do is surrounded by guys, you know, and now you're in a restaurant and someone's like has a family next to you. Like, oh, I'm sorry. So you have to catch yourself. There's a lot of corrections you have to do, but it's the same with the pauses and the ums and the likes and sures and like, you know, whatever. You have to see what you're doing, catch yourself and slow down. Like right now I'm going really fast. A few ums snuck out, but when you slow down, you can catch them and prevent them from happening. But that's just some advice. And again, that book that you read is a bunch of advice in there. That's why it's from the mundane to the metaphysical, because that advice is mundane. It's just earthly stuff, how to speak better. And then there's stuff like, does God exist? What's the point of life? That's why it goes from, you know, one thing to another, and the topics are not the same in each entry.
Yes. I was very struck. Well, first of all, I really hadn't heard of you until I got a copy of your book from the publisher, and the publisher is a friend of mine.
And
yes, Turning the Tide Publishing. Mm-hmm. Who did you say the publisher was?
Oh, Dave, my friend Dave.
Yes, Dave. Oh,
good old Dave.
Yes. I love Dave.
And he spent a lot of time editing with me, like at least 6 months. I wrote the book in a year, and then we spent together 6 months on Skype, 4 hours at a time, 8 hours, and massive amounts of time. Editing with this man, and he spent a lot. Again, it's time is money, but he's like, no, you're my brother, you're my friend. And so he helped me, he taught me a lot of grammar. So I learned how to be a better editor myself. So now when I see articles, like, oh, where's the comma? This guy's missing a colon. This guy, and I learned to chop words down. Dave was like, you're using that too much. You're using that, this. I'm like, all right, fine. So he can help me refine my writing skill. It took 6 months, but totally worth it. And, right. But, we did the right thing. He invested his time in me. And I mean, we've been friends for years. And that's why I said, you know what?
Really?
We've been friends. Yeah. Not like I met him in person, but we've been online friends, and, we're in the same struggle, if you will. And we know what's going on in the world. And so that's why I said, you know what? The paperback's going to be with you, because I want to support small businesses.
Right.
You know, I don't want to support Scamazon, although my Kindle version is on Scamazon, you know, just for easier for people who want electronic. But I said, Dave, we'll go with you to the end. You know, let's just do it. We'll do it. Help the business, small business. Again, he invested a lot of his time editing with me and helping me as well. So I'm a very loyal friend, you know.
Me too.
And that's what it's all about. We really got to start helping each other as this world is more globalized and these corporations are taking over everything. So that's crucial, I think. So that's one of the reasons why I was with Turning the Tide Publishing, still am, don't plan on leaving it. And that's the point of a friendship, is to be loyal to each other. So, but yes, Dave helped me edit it and taught me a lot. So I really appreciate his efforts and his work as well, because it made the book way better. There were so many things that had to go, because it's really free flowing, you know, but when you free flow, sometimes you repeat things. And he's like, Angelo, you already said this in the first sentence and the last one. I'm like, oh, okay, let's get rid of it. So it's hard. It's a hard job to be an editor and stuff.
Right. Yeah, he's really kind of a perfectionist, I think.
Oh, yeah, yes, and that's good.
But in a very casual kind of a way, he doesn't make you feel like, oh, my gosh, you've done something wrong here. He's more... I don't know. He's just
a gentle
giant. He just has a finesse about him. Yes, a gentle giant.
Well, you know, it's funny because we would edit it over and over and we would miss things. And I'm like, Dave, how did we miss this? It's so stupid and it's right there. He's like, I don't know. It's, that's the craziness. I'm like, is there a perfect book? He's like, no. I'm looking for perfection too. Yeah, I'm looking for perfection too. Yeah. So
I did find a couple of editorial edits and I thought, oh no, that word should be this. Mm-hmm. But the book is really great. And I really cannot believe how much we have in common. There are some things we don't share, that we don't have commonality with, but one of the things is that, I went to Paris Island as a Marine also.
Oh wow. I didn't know that.
And when I read that, I thought, oh my gosh. We've both been to Paris Island. I went in the summertime. Now you went after 9/11, and we went for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. I went several years before you did, but it was summer, and I remember the heat, hurricane warnings. I remember the discipline was incredible. It was just absolutely incredible. One time I was standing, we were lined up, and our platoon was, I think there were probably four rows, and you're not supposed to move anything, you're not supposed to move your nothing. But I did glance down, and the girl in front of me, because we were all girls, there weren't any women there. We were all girls. And I glanced down. There's this great big bug on her leg. There was blood dripping down, running down her leg because this bug was biting her. And we're not supposed to flinch. We're not supposed to swat at flies or do any of those kinds of things. And I do remember having panic attacks when I guess I was just, I had panic attacks. And when I had a panic attack, usually they occurred at night, they would put a paper bag over my head to calm my breathing down. And it was effective, but just some of the things that I learned, and today, just for fun, I still have my laundry bag from the Marine Corps with my number on it. And, just because I knew you were going to be on the program, I looked at it and I thought, oh, this is so amazing that I kept this. And they referred to women Marines as BAMs.
BAMs,
B-A-M. Do they still do that or no?
I don't remember I don't think we didn't even interact with the Marines of, the females because I was in third platoon and they had the fourth platoon was like separated from the males.
Right. So they had us separated, right.
Yeah. But I don't remember what I don't think we called them anything.
Well, what they referred to us as BAM, B-A-M, was broad. Imagine the second word, mm-hmm. Marine, broad the Marine,
mm-hmm.
and which is really not very nice. But at the end of the and we had a male DI and who was very, very rough. Oh my gosh, he was something else. And we had swimming lessons, we had all kinds of things. And on graduation day, I believe it was 12 weeks that I was there. We're going to a quick break. We will be back momentarily.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me.
All righty, we are back with our guest today, who is Angelo John Gage. His website is angelojohngage.com. And you can follow him on Twitter, which I do. And it's very, very interesting. And I do have to ask you this. Well, let me finish with the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll ask you about your tweet just before the program. So anyway, on graduation day, this drill sergeant, this male drill sergeant, who had been just not very nice, hit on me. And I thought, my gosh, what a jerk. He was old enough to be my father, and he's hitting on me. And I was assigned to El Toro, which is in California, and I was assigned to the dispersing office. And I enjoyed the work, but the service is not a place for women. I'm totally against women being in the service.
Yeah, it's interesting you had a male DI, because when I went, there was only female DIs for the females. So that must have changed a lot since then when you were in.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a totally different thing. We barely saw any of them. And when we did see them once, it was for the swim tests. And we're all like, oh, look at all these girls. Because we're all 18 and we haven't seen them in months. But yeah, they had female DIs like screaming, you know, at them, and it's totally different separation. But I went to boot camp 4 days after high school, right after, I graduated. I was also went through the summer. So June 2002 on the 24th, I believe, and all the way to August. So 3 months during the hottest months. We had Black Flag days where you couldn't go out because it was too hot. We had, the bugs everywhere. So yeah, I experienced the same, South Carolina weather you did.
Oh, that's
nice. And I'll tell you my story, which is funny. You talk about discipline. I spit on the floor once in the parade deck, and my drill instructor called me. He's like, you better put that spit in your pocket right now, boy. Pick up that spit, put it in your pocket. And I literally picked up my own spit and put it in my pocket. That's the kind of obedience they teach you. You don't question it. And there also was a time where I had a bug on my face. It was a mosquito. I had to sit there. I couldn't scratch it. You know, you can't do anything, like you said. So this girl you saw was getting eaten by a bug. I had to pick up my own spit on the floor, fly in your face, mosquito, you just can't scratch it. That's the discipline that you have to do, because it's drill instructing, you know, they're making you in formation. I'll never forget those things, but you know, it makes you tougher. It really does.
It does,
but yeah.
And the bugs, it's this bug that was on this girl's leg. It was huge. It wasn't some little mosquito. It was big. Yeah. I've never seen such big bugs. And we did have the Black Flag days, and and it was the humidity was awful. It was quite an experience.
Did they throw you into the pit when you did bad things, like the sand pit, to do push-ups and sit-ups and get all your camis sanded up for a week? Because we only had 1 week. One day of the week that we put our camis in to get laundry. So we would, if we got punished outside, I'll get in the pit right now with the frog voice, push ups, sit ups, everything. And then you get all the sand in your body and it's all sandy for a week. It's kind of terrible. But that's what they did to us. They did that to us. And then you're dirty all the time, which you get used to actually. I don't mind being dirty for a long time, but,
I remember going into, a big hut. It's very lengthy, where you had to hold your breath and and not breathe because they were shooting gas or whatever. Is that?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
What was that?
It was tear gas. Oh no, it's I think it was not tear gas. It's I forgot what it is. Is it tear gas? It's something.
It's something awful noxious.
Yeah, it's not good. I forgot what it is. I don't think it's tear, it's worse than tear gas, but it might be tear gas. I forget what it is exactly, but it makes you cough. Did you have a gas mask or were they just?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you had to do it without.
Yeah. Oh, you did it without it. Wow. We had a gas mask and we had to put it in as quick as we could, but everyone would get caught up first and they make you exhale and then make you breathe it in. So yeah, it was like very burning, like pepper spray type of thing.
Right. Yes. Oh, it was awful.
Yep. Yeah.
And I remember going through the vaccine line, which I'm anti-vaxxer. Mm-hmm. And I think about all of that experience and I think, oh my gosh. When I was there, I was asking myself, what am I doing here? And then after I was stationed, and of course the majority of the Marines are male, and I'm glad that I had a good job in the dispersing office. There was only probably two other women. And rather than work in supply, I did have a good job.
Yeah.
So that was good. Okay, we do have a break. We'll be right back momentarily.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good. To live in harmony, it starts with you.
All right, we are back. Our guest today is Angelo John Gage. His website is angelojohngage.com. And he is the author of From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. And anyway, let me just finish up my Marine Corps story. I grew up in my bedroom reading books. Mm-hmm. I could not, all these people in the barracks, I just couldn't deal with all these people around me. So I was, although I got an honorable discharge, I was only in for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't, I just couldn't do it. It was just, I remember I had KP duty, which was horrible. You get up at 3 a.m. and you go over and you have to stay there till 7 o'clock at night, mop, clean up everything after you've served 3 meals a day. I think that did me in.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't built to live with all of these energies around me, all these people, these what I considered girls. It was
not for everybody. Yeah, it wasn't even for me, but I just forced myself to go through it. I was all about the Marine Corps until I got into the Marine Corps, and there was a lot of politics involved and all this nonsense, and I was doing really well. I did very well. I got meritorious Lance Corporal. I was in engineer school because I was a combat engineer, and then when I got to Kuwait, I got in trouble because I wrote a letter to my girlfriend at the time about what we're going to do. Like, it's obvious what we're going to do, and one of my own fire team leaders turned in a letter, "What are you doing, Gage?" and got me in trouble. He could have just ripped it up and said, "Go fill a sandbag." I didn't understand what I was writing. You know, I was like, "Hey, we're going to go to Iraq. We're going to build bridges and this OPSEC." And they destroyed me. They took away my rank. I was like, "This is not a brotherhood." Yeah, that's so. Thank God that happened. But you know, then I got my stuff together and I became a corporal and I got out honorable discharge, everything, got my GI Bill, everything I could from these people.
Right.
It was the worst decision ever made, but everything after it, all the medical disability, everything I get from it, it came as a blessing in disguise, to be honest with you.
Oh, exactly.
So
I used the benefits to purchase a house.
Yes.
The loan you can get, the veteran loan.
Mm-hmm.
And I also went to college. It was good. It was a good experience. It was a learning okay, it wasn't a good experience. It was a learning experience.
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, I enjoy the friendships I've made. I didn't mind the authoritarian lifestyle of that kind of structure. But when I saw my leadership, who were incompetent fools, I couldn't respect it anymore. So then, and it was politically too. There's a lot of politics being played.
And
who's trying to get, and who's good side. I'm like, this is ridiculous. So that's why I didn't like it after that. And I was against authority. I became like absolute opposite when I got to college. I started reading philosophies and all this other stuff. I'm like, oh, I hate all this stuff, you know. And
right.
That's when I got into conspiracy world. That's what I went down the conspiracy rabbit. Every conspiracy you can imagine. Once I learned about 9/11 and all this other stuff going on in the world, I read everything for years. And I was like, wow, this whole planet, this whole world, this whole history even has been lies. And I was like, whoa.
Right.
That was a big pill to swallow for me, because I just served this, Marine Corps, which works for the Israelis and the bankers and all that.
Oh, right.
I had no idea. I had no idea what I was doing. But that's why I'm a fervent anti-war person. And as you read in my book, you see my stance on war and all these other things. So for me, it's just like my learning experience was one that changed my life. I would never do it again. I tell people don't join. I don't care how much money they give you or what you can get out of it. But for me, it's something I would never do again, but I can't regret it because it's something that changed my life in many positive ways. And the benefits that I got now for my family, my children, everything, it's just too much. It was a blessing in disguise. That's for me. That's what it was. And I didn't, I got PTSD. I got screwed up. Yes. And luckily I didn't kill anyone in Iraq. Thank God. Thank God none of my friends died during our tours. But, it was still a terrible experience to be there in this war zone, seeing people die and stuff. But luckily if I took someone's life, I don't know how I would have been if I would have been alive after that. But thank God I didn't,
Right. Reading your book, excuse me, I can tell that, well, you're a very sensitive person, and you experience PTSD, which I have also, but not under the same situation.
Yeah.
But I do remember that because I was dealing with finances and temporary additional duty and getting accounts and that kind of thing, working in the bookkeeping aspect of everything. And I saw how much people were sending back to their family, and I'm thinking, how are these people supposed to live? It was just a very eye-opening experience.
Yep.
And we did, during boot camp, we had classes, and during the classes I thought, this doesn't sound right. This is really, it just was very eye-opening. I probably wouldn't trade my experience, but I just wouldn't do it again. And I would highly recommend that no female join any kind of service, particularly when they're in a foreign country, because there's a lot of rape.
Yep.
A lot of that sexual attacks, it was, as I mentioned, before I even left Paris Island, at the DI, I was just shocked.
Yeah.
Here he had been this one person, and the minute I graduated, it was really awful, because I thought that these people had honor and
dignity. Well, yeah.
And here he's trying to, it was like that. It was like that.
Well, it's like throwing a girl in a frat house. It's just not a good idea. That's what it is. The Marine Corps is a giant frat house, and there are women, more women now than before, but yeah, it's just, you can't change that dynamic between male and female, especially in the war zone, especially in, when women are very scarce, in the Marine Corps. It's not like there's women everywhere, but
right.
It's just, I agree with you. I don't think it's for women, but people are going to join and do what they want to do, but.
Well, I did it with the best of intentions. I thought, serve my country.
Yep.
What a laugh.
Yeah.
What a big laugh. Anyway, as I said, I follow you on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the messages you said today, Amazon to do vaccine deliveries with drones. Order your vaccine today. Family discounts available. What was that all
about? I'm just making fun of it.
Oh.
I say stupid things on Twitter sometimes to make fun of the whole situation we're in. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Amazon something for the vaccine and get a discount, you know? So I make jokes. I'm a serious person, but I have to make jokes in this insane world to keep everyone laughing at some point, you know? I would drive myself crazy if I didn't make fun of this situation we're in right now, you know? So that's what that was. No, it's fake news, obviously. And people know it. They should know. But if you follow me long enough, you'll see I'll make jokes here and there. Because I have to – it's always serious. You know, Palestinians getting shot. This is going on. This is – here's a joke to, you know, break things up. You know what I mean? But, yeah. But would you be surprised if that was the case? I wouldn't be. I would
– No, I wouldn't be. I thought, well, that would be really good. You could just say, oh – I've already had the shot, so you don't need to worry about sending the military to do your warp speed vaccine on me.
Yeah, I put a tweet saying masks will be on until 2030, and people were like, I'm just making it up, you know, but it's just people know, the people who follow me, they know I'm joking. But that's how crazy this clown world is. I wouldn't be surprised, they did something like that. Warp speed drone, who knows, but anyway, yeah, that's what that was about.
Oh, okay. I wanted to clarify that because sometimes I don't know when something is a joke, I think.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The world is so crazy, you can't even tell anymore.
Right.
You can't tell. I mean,
who would know?
Exactly.
Amazon sells everything else.
Yeah. So.
Okay, you have talked about so many things in your book. You've talked about organized religion, and you grew up Catholic.
Yep.
And you left your church, which I did also. I didn't grow up Catholic, but I did formally leave my church, and because it just, anytime you're in a 501c3, which is a corporation, you're not going to have freedom of religion. You're going to be bound by the corporation, and it's a big, it's really, it's a way of corporations, and the one that I left was really, because I had done a lot of research in the background, was really actually family owned. But one wouldn't know it unless they spent hours doing all this research to figure out that everybody that's in leadership positions now were in leadership positions back from the 1830s on. And I think, holy cow, this is really troubling. So you left organized religion, and you've written about, you know, the book. Oh, I said a, you know.
That's okay. It's not, you have to be perfect.
The book is divided into sections. And as I was going through the sections, I just felt like I knew you. I just, you're so sensitive. How did you get so sensitive?
A lot of suffering. That's what it is. It's a lot of suffering in life, a lot of thinking and putting yourself in people's shoes, being betrayed, being lied to. That's what it comes down to. So you experienced that kind of suffering, and a lot of suffering I caused myself with my ego. A lot of the book is about taming the ego. So a lot of my suffering I made up in my head and just made myself suffer even more. And I learned to, you know, let go of it and conquer it or tame it, as I write in the book. Because a lot of our problems are made up. We just make them up. There's no problem. We're fine. And all of a sudden, well, this, that, we make them up in our head. Who's talking about us? What's going on? Am I going to fail in life? Am I not going to fail? All these conversations drive you insane, you know, and I'm a very introverted person too. I'm not really a social person. I could be social.
Right.
I like to be alone. I like to be doing my own thing. So, you know, for me, I put my heart on my sleeve. I've been betrayed by people, business partners, whatever you name it. And I said, wow. And then why did they do this to me? Cause they're suffering. You see, they need something more than I do. And there's just this constant cycle. So the reason why I became sensitive, I mean, I'm also like, you know, still a former Marine tough guy person, but I have these personalities where I go from stoic philosopher like Marcus Aurelius, who I love very much.
Oh, this, right. I got
to
that.
This warrior guy who just wants to destroy the enemy. That, and then this Joker guy who's a clown who makes a joke like you just saw. So I have like tripolar, if you will. There's like these three people in me. And, in the middle there, there's this sensitivity between all of them where I can really empathize with people. That's why I'm anti-war. I'm very anti. I look at the people we bombed and killed and I go, wow, look at these people in our homes. So the war and seeing the worst of mankind made me sensitive to it. And, you know, cause I used to always try to be like Terminator, like Schwarzenegger. I want to be tough guy, da, da, da. But that's not my true nature either. You know, I do have the toughness when I need it, but I also have the sensitive side when I need it. And when I'm writing a book that I want to help people with it, it's really a self-help book, if you will. Most of it, there is politics, there is different stuff, but it's me sharing how I've overcome my suffering. So I have to be sensitive as I deliver this message to people. So they take it. If I was just like, you're stupid, I can't do that. I can't be this tough guy. I'm not coaching a football team. I'm trying to life coach a person who's been through whatever they've been through. And so I want to share my intimate experiences with people so they feel comfortable to open up to them, you know, to themselves even while they're reading my material and say, wow, I've been through that too. Not exactly that, but something like that. I could connect with this person. I can feel what the author's saying. He feels what I'm saying. That's what I wanted to do with this book. And I think I've achieved it.
Oh, you have.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so. And I could tell that you were an introvert just because you do a lot of introverted things. You do a lot of thinking. So it is amazing that you could place yourself in a situation, such as the Marine Corps with all these people around you. It's just amazing that you could do that. Yep. I couldn't do it. It just was too much.
Well, I have that warrior in me. My grandfather was in the Air Force. He was a major. My great-great-grandfather was a Marine too. So I have that warrior blood in me. My father skipped that generation, skipped him. But I can be tough. Obviously I can be. Sometimes too cold. I could be extremely cold at times, which I need to balance. It's another ego thing too. So I could be any person I have to be when I need to be. But the book is really me being very sensitive because these are sensitive topics.
Right.
Yep.
Well, my grandfather was also in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
He was Schmedley Butler's aide.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he was, they were in Haiti together. They were in China together. And of course, Schmedley Butler wrote War is a Racket.
Yep.
Which I failed to read before I joined. And my grandfather, I didn't actually meet my grandfather until I was 14.
Wow.
Because my grandparents had gotten a divorce. And then I thought, I'm just going to write to him. And I want to know who he was because my mother hated him so obviously, well, not obviously, my mother hated him, so I was going to find out why, because that's just who I was. And he immediately responded. He came to Sacramento, where I grew up, and immediately made contact with me, and he's my spirit guide now. He's passed away. Mm-hmm. For the longest time, even now, okay, we'll pick this up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back. Alright, we are back with our guest, Angelo John Gage. His website is angelojohngage.com. He is the author of From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. It's written for every person. You will find yourself saying, well, gosh, that's the way I feel too. And I felt really just, I connected in so many areas, and I could, I really felt like, it's just an incredible book. You will connect. You will connect with this gentleman, and it will make you more aware of yourself and other people around you. And you talk about the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And you talk about Big Pharma, which is just, they've taken, first of all, you talk about the war of drugs as it began in 1971.
Yeah.
And we had, what, the war on cancer and the war on this and the war on that. And to make everything a war about something, you think that the politicians are, oh, wow, they're really serious about this, when in fact it's just the very opposite, because they're in bed with Big Pharma.
Yep.
So tell us your feelings. It seems like I'm doing a lot of talking, and I don't want to take away from you. You have a lot of things in your book that you express so well, and I don't want to I don't want to mess that up.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, you tell me your feelings about the Big Pharma or the war on drugs, which are just how I feel about the book itself.
Let's talk about just Big Pharma first.
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, Big Pharma is exempt from their products. For example, this vaccine that just came out. Now, I'm not an anti-vaxxer in the sense that I think they're going to kill you, but I am extremely against forcing anyone to do anything against their will in regards to their body autonomy. So if you don't want to take a vaccine, don't take it. But I don't agree with the CDC schedule for, like, my son, for example. I spaced his vaccine so far, he was so behind. You know what I mean? So I did not say, get 5 in one shot. I couldn't do it. And you look back in time, when I was younger, we had like 7 shots. Now there's like 72 shots. It's insane. And this is with companies that have no liability. That's incredible to me. And there is a vaccine injury court, but when you go to that court, you're suing the government, which means you're suing yourself and the people. So, you know, this is the worst thing imaginable. But what I mentioned about Big Pharma was the drugs. For example, I don't mention the Sacker family exactly. I don't remember
mentioning the name. Oh, gosh.
But that, the opium crisis, that they killed people I knew. People, because I was a party maniac in the scene in New York and all that. And I knew people who did those drugs, and they died. Just died. Normal people, you know, they didn't have any problem. They just did drugs and partied too hard, and they had Oxycontin and the oxytocin, whatever it's called. And the Sacker family did get sued for like $8 billion, but that's nothing. You know, they have so much money. That's what I mean about the war on drugs. There is no war, really, because our politicians get these people off the hook. They put these no liability clauses in these vaccines or other products as well. And people get away with murder, literally. Get away with murder and pay a fine, which is nothing to these people. Their assets should be seized, all of them, and they should be put on trial for murdering people. You know, that's my view. That's how you stop a war on drugs. And also with the cartels, and that's another version of the other part of the book, too. I talk about cartels and all that other stuff. But, yeah, there's no war on drugs in this country. There's the war on you as a person over your body and what you can or cannot put in your body. And when it comes to things like, if you want to smoke marijuana, I don't do it. But if you want to do it, I don't see why it's now it's becoming legal, etc. But, you know, it's funny. You can drink and smoke cigarettes, which will kill you even more than any of these things. Apparently the government cares about you. So that's my argument in the book. You know, why are these substances legal while these other ones that don't hurt you are illegal? That's another argument I make as well. But ultimately, my feelings with Big Pharma is that they need to be held accountable and they need to be punished harshly. And they should actually be nationalized, in my opinion. They shouldn't even be private. It makes no sense to make it a private company, let people do what they want, and then buy our congressmen and all that other stuff. But, you know, people have different opinions on Big Pharma, but mine is I don't trust them, and their products have hurt people. I'm not going to say they haven't helped humanity in some cases, of course, But there are many times where people were injured by like Vioxx and other things that they had. And where's the accountability? You know, where's a few fines is not accountability, especially when they make that 10 times over in profit.
Right. The other thing too is that when a person is vaccinated, mm-hmm. and as you said, they now say 72 vaccines.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
We're already there. We're already there. We're flying.
We're having a good time. Okay, we'll be right back. It's the top of the hour. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Guest today is Angelo John Gage. He is an author. His book is fabulous. It's called From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. It's a wonderful book. It's put out by Turning the Tide Publishing. And it's a book that everyone can relate to this book. I don't think there's anybody that couldn't relate to what you have written and that wouldn't grow and be a better person for having read your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I made it where there's certainly things you won't agree with, right? Because I cover a span of different ages too. For example, I talk about video games. Well, what do you have to do with that, right? But that's me getting to a younger audience because I used to grow up with video games. But I talk about metaphysical questions like about the universe, about life and existence. This is something older people may think of, you see, or a younger person may not care about. And then there's personal things like relationships, love, you know, depression, anxiety. Right. These are things we've all gone through. And then some exercises in NLP, how to get rid of certain things, you know, to do in your mind to help you. So there's absolutely not a single person who would read this book and say, I absolutely hate all of it. They might hate some of it, but not all of it. You know,
well, I have yet to run into anything that I dislike. I appreciate and respect everything that I have read. Getting back to the vaccine issue.
Sure. Yeah.
And you brought up the vaccine court. Now, when you go in, or when you take your child in and they want to give you 6 vaccines or 3 vaccines, you pay for each specific vaccine that you are receiving 75 cents. That goes toward toward a fund so that if people do decide to sue because of vaccine injury, that fund will pay, and they have paid out billions. I'm not sure the exact. I'm not up on the very, very current amounts that they've paid out. But when you look at the vaccine ingredients, when you see formaldehyde, aluminum, mercury, aborted fetal tissue, and all of these other things, you think, do I really want to put aluminum in my body? Do I want to put this dye in my body? Parents really do need to look at what they're putting in their body or what they're allowing a doctor to put in their body, because vaccines are, I believe, part of a depopulation program and Big Pharma. And you said it yourself. Big Pharma wants to keep patients lifelong.
Oh yeah, it's a business model. No business model is to lose business, right?
Right, and you talked about the Sackler family.
Yes.
And a lot of people are in pain, and you're talking about personal pain, emotional pain, And there are an awful lot of people who are in pain in this country and looking for something to assuage that pain. And you've done it using a different method. You have faced it straight on, which shows you have a lot of courage. And so that I respect you a great deal for that you evaluated things because you are an introvert.
Yes.
You evaluated things and they do have gods of money, and a particular ethnic group has been they've been the drug dealers for a very, very long time, beginning back in the Opium War in mm-hmm. China. So that there's a trail of dead bodies that is very lengthy, and yet we have politicians who are in bed with these people,
yep.
who allow it, who are bought and paid for. They're compromised. They're corrupt. And you talk about the political situation, and you talk about how it's not workable.
No.
So talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in the book, I talk about this whole, like, left versus right paradigm, and they
right.
split the people in half. And I basically also mentioned about the media, how it's one of the greatest weapons of mass deception, next to the banking cartel. So the cartels have all the money, the banking cartel, they put everyone in debt, but in order to keep their power, they have to deceive the people. And they make this like sports kind of thing. It's like sports, like, oh, left wing versus right, we're a Republican versus Democrat. And I compare it to a sports game or like a Super Bowl. It's every election is a Super Bowl. So everyone's yelling at each other, screaming at each other. Oh, you voted for this guy. It's your fault. Meanwhile, the bankers are robbing us all blind. And that's how it's been for at least a century in this country. And who knows how long, for millennia, they've been doing this. But ultimately, I say that this is, the whole system makes no sense. This whole two-party system doesn't make sense. You need a one-party state. We've seen it in history happen before. It does work. Of course, they demonize these people as much as they can because they want to end up replicating it. But you need to do that. I mean, you wouldn't run a business like this. You wouldn't run a business where half your board hates you and wants to not do the same product as you. You can't run a business like that. You need to unify the people and have a one-party state or one-party states of many states, you know, whatever you want to do. But to me, I said to someone, I was interviewed by some person from one of these watch orgs or whatever, I forgot, like Turning Point Memo or something. She's like, so what do you think about this? And why don't we just split the country in half? Democrats go to left, country, everyone else go to the right. You know, split it in half, let's live in our own people. And she said, oh, that's a good idea. But the problem is the system is made that they don't want us to do anything like that. No form of unification. It has to be diversified in every way possible, religiously, racially, you name it. And they put us against each other so that we attack each other and never attack them. So anything that unifies the people, they don't want it. So having a two-party system like this where you blame the other people, it's the Republicans, the Democrats, it's this, that's, they love that. And that's what the media does. The media is controlled. There's six corporations controlled by the same people, essentially, who have the same interests, and they just play each other off another. And then you have these arguments. And so we have to be very careful and see through this sham and say, okay, well, you know, how do we solve the problem? How do we eliminate the 1%, the parasite class, the banking cartels, the military industrial cartels? We can't do it yelling at each other. That's what they want. So how do we do that? It's going to be hard to do, but ultimately learning the truth that we're being deceived, many people don't want to accept that because their ego doesn't want to accept that. And that's why I say a lot of people, they'll believe things that make no sense because they're invested in it and it would destroy their lives. Imagine me, I'm a Marine. I was in my barracks. My friend showed me a video of 9/11. I was like, what the hell is this? My whole life was like upside down. I'm like, I just served the wrong people. I just served Israel. You know, what's going on here? So I had to accept that red pill. A lot of people don't want to accept the truth because it hurts too much and it will destroy their worldview. I mean, look, I was Catholic for 23 years. I served the Marine Corps. Those two things I had to let go. I had to let go of those things. I believed in Catholicism for 23 years, and I started questioning religion. I said, wait a minute, it doesn't make any sense. And I just said, I let go of it. And I, you know, in my book, I do talk about what God could be, right? I'm not like saying I'm an atheist, but technically I'm a pantheist. But I talk about Alan Watts, who's one of my favorite guys, philosopher-wise. And he's like, everything is God, essentially Taoism, if you will, kind of an Eastern philosophy. But I don't believe in a personal being with anger issues who floods people. I don't believe that.
Oh, I don't believe that. Yeah. My gosh.
Yeah, but people believe that. And you know what? Fine. Believe what you want. My father's Catholic. He always asks that question to me. We always talk about it. I respect people's religion. I don't care. But I always just tend not to discuss it, you know, because there's no point. But at the end of the day, they use religion, they use everything, race, they use even man versus woman now, children, any division they can imagine, they'll use it. And that's why they are successful in usurping nations, destroying them, putting them in debt, and causing chaos, because the people, they let it happen, essentially, and they think they're doing the right thing. They think they're morally correct in their viewpoint, when morality, in my view, is subjective. It's an opinion. And that's it. And so how can you win an opinion? You can't. So you're going to fight about it and go back and forth while these bankers and these parasites take all your money, all your assets, and eventually continue to enslave you. And you're okay with it. People are okay with it. Well, what can we do? Because that's how it's always been. You know, that's what I hear all the time. And that's why it's always been that way. But we've seen in history, we've seen people stand up to the bankers and fight them. And, you know, it can be done. It's just that you need to have the whole world on the same page to take right. These people out. You can't just have one or two countries wake up, because then they'll just send the other countries to destroy you. You see?
Right. Sure.
So that's why this awakening has to be global.
And unfortunately, when you look at this COVID scam, it's worldwide. So there are a few countries who have not locked down, but they're few and far between. And They've tried to bribe them, say, oh, we'll give you this much, this many billion dollars if you'll go along with this. But it is a worldwide scam. And it's, I can't believe how many people have fallen for this. I listened to, earlier today, I listened to Jerry Day, talk about this. He's got a 12-minute video. Discusses the situation with COVID. It is so blatant. I don't know why so many people are buying into this, but I think fear does this. Fear makes you very vulnerable. One of the things that you talked about in your book is capital punishment.
Oh, yeah.
I love what you say about capital punishment.
I'm a big fan. I don't know. It's something my father's like, no, because he's Catholic. No, you can't do that. God, listen, you know, for me, unless you know that you're going to die for what you've done, you're going to do it. If you know that you're going to go to jail for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, eat 3 meals a day, do push-ups, play cards, you're not going to really be afraid to stop your crimes, you know. So for me, I'm a big fan of capital punishment because it's also a sign of mercy, if you think about it. Like, here's a guy who's a pedophile. He's raped children. There's something wrong with him. He's sick. He probably doesn't even want to be that way.
He's evil.
He's evil too, but maybe there's some genetic. You're doing him a favor. Put him to sleep. You know, it's like, why put him in a box and pay 30 years life prison taxes and feeding him? Just put him to sleep like you would put a dog to sleep who bit somebody. I look at it like, so it is tough, but it's also a form of mercy if you look at it. Just put these people out of commission. Just take them away. But we don't do that. We really don't do that. And that's why I think criminals do what they want. We definitely don't do it to the people who deserve it on the top, which is why they do what they want to do across the world. But that's the thing. I'm a big fan of it because I believe it's necessary. And if I were to ever commit a crime that's worthy of it, I wouldn't even resist it. I would take it, you know, I wouldn't do a crime like that, but I think it's necessary. We're not tough on crime, and I think capital punishment, not 10 years on death row, 20, 30 years, instantly.
Right!
Quickly. I mean, but it has to, and in the book, I outline what kind of prerequisites you need to, because, you know, Angela, what if you kill someone who's innocent? We're not going to do that, you see? It has to be, like, irrefutably true. The evidence has to be so perfect that it's impossible to do it, you know?
Right.
And certain crimes as well. Because there have been people who have been executed wrongfully. you know, but we would have measure. I mentioned in the book how we could avoid that. But yeah, that was, yeah. So anyway, I cut you off there. What were you going to say? What's your thing? So you like my view on it.
Oh, I love it. Yes, I do. Absolutely. I love it. And I, because you see these people who are guilty and they keep, having their lawyer do a stay of execution. They do this. And I'm thinking, my gosh, what is wrong? Why can't they effectively do the law if there's a capital, if they've committed a capital crime? They just, and that includes politicians.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Particularly politicians. When you look at the background of so many of our politicians, from World War One forward, or well, even before, but World War One forward, gosh, you had the Bush family involved with the arms movement industry. These people have been making money off murdering, slaughtering other people in other countries for decades. They slaughter people. I get so upset about this.
Well,
they slaughter people, okay?
Yeah, and that's why they just, I wrote corruption, government corruption should be punishable by death, period.
Absolutely.
Any form, any, even a stupid thing. You've given the trust of the country. Let's suppose someone stole $1 from the U.S. Treasury. You just stole from 320 million Americans. How many life sentences is that? Might as well just put you down because you're a criminal in the highest office, you see? So I think the more power you're given, the more harsh your punishment should be because of the trust you're given. You know, people say that's not fair. It's not supposed to be fair when you have that much power and you violate your oath and you steal from the people. Government corruption, in my view, death penalty. And then it will end. Nobody would sign up to even be someone in Congress if they knew. If a congressperson knew, I'm going to run for Congress, I could be killed if anything, you know, if I'm corrupt. 99% of the people today would resign instantly. If I were to pass a law tomorrow, from now on, corruption is death penalty, these guys would all resign, all of them. And I would join because I know I wouldn't care if I did. I wouldn't be corrupt.
Sure.
You know, so only the good people would join.
The problem is that they're the ones that are making the laws. Mm-hmm. It's the criminals who are making the laws.
Yep.
So we cannot effectively implement what should be in place because they are the ones that control the courts. They control Congress. They control the media.
Yep.
So it's...
You need a populist movement. Populist,
yes.
Mass movement of unified people to say we've had enough.
Right.
That's what you need.
Right.
And we've seen it. Deanna, we've seen it before in history. We've seen it, and you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
And
yes,
it could happen. And it probably will happen again because these people never stop doing what they always do. And so hopefully it happens in our lifetime. That's all I can say.
That would be terrific.
Yes.
That would be really terrific. You also talk about abortion, and in conjunction with murder. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Scott Peterson, who was convicted of murdering his wife, who was 8 months pregnant? Her name was Lacey Peterson. He murdered her on Christmas Eve in 2002. Okay, we'll be right back with our guest.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts.
All right, we are back with our guest. I just love that song. It was written by a listener. And it just really says what I believe. Anyway, Scott Peterson murdered his wife. She was 8 months pregnant with their unborn son, and he dumped their bodies in the San Francisco Bay, and they surfaced several months later.
Ugh.
And he was he's probably still alive. So it's been 20 years. And he was convicted for killing two people rather than one person. And yet, if you have a license to perform an abortion, you can do it. See, the government has to give you a license to kill people.
Yes.
Yes, if you performed an abortion on your neighbor, you would be jailed. Yep. If you gave your neighbor the ingredients of a vaccine, if you injected your neighbor with those ingredients, or your own child, you would be convicted of trying to poison somebody. You have to be licensed by the government in order to commit a crime.
Pretty much. No, it's interesting because, you mentioned it's two people, the double homicide. Yeah. So.
Right.
And now it's like the problem with abortion, I see it. I have a pretty balanced stance. I say, it should only be done in extreme circumstances. It should be last resort, to spare the child of a disease or the mother of death or so. And it, honestly, if you're a mother who's going to die delivering your kid, you should probably let your kid live. That's just me. But some people wouldn't do that. But I am against the abortions of convenience. In other words, I mentioned in the book that if somebody's like, oh, I'm pregnant, well, I don't want to ruin my career and kill this baby. So that shouldn't be possible. You know, it should be, this is a medical emergency or within a certain, like, 6 weeks or something small, whatever the case. I mean, I try to find a balance between women's rights, but I tell people, when they say my body, my choice, it's not really your body though. There's a body growing inside of your body. And I want you to understand that. That's what I'm trying to tell people, to look at it that way. Because just now Argentina passed a law allowing women to have an abortion in 14 weeks. And there are thousands of women in the street yelling and screaming with joy. Do you see the sickness there, Deanna? These are women who are happy to kill babies that are growing, and that left at their own devices, the baby will develop. And that's arguments. What about your sperm? What about if you go do this? And but once the things are put together, human life is created. And again, I'm not super like, oh, once it happens, it's there. I'm about, let's be logical about this. Let's not kill children after the second trimester. Let's not, you know, you have 1 month to make a decision for whatever reason, finances, whatever. But even so, why did you get pregnant? You didn't use contraceptives. You didn't use protection. You were lazy. You were promiscuous. You know, really, most abortions could be avoided by having safe sex. I mean, obviously, right? Or not at all. And so abortions of convenience are really done by people who are promiscuous. And I'll tell you my own story. My girlfriend and I, we had unprotected sex a long time when I was younger, and she was impregnated, and she was 6 weeks, and you know, we were doing drugs, we were partying, drinking. I'm like, I can't have a kid at this age. We're 28 or 26, and who knows what the substances would do to our fetus. So we had an abortion, and I wonder to this day, I don't talk to her anymore. I'm married to someone else. I wonder what would my 10-year-old be like. So even me as a man, I'm like, man, I killed somebody who could have been. Did I spare the child the life of, you know, drama and talk? Who knows? Maybe. But I've done it. So I know from my own personal experience that was an abortion of convenience. It was. And some people say, no, it's actually good. You spared them, you know, something. You don't want these kids, yada, yada. But really, I took a human life because you cannot argue. I argue in the book. You cannot argue that it's not a human life. It is a human life. It's a human life at a certain stage. No different than someone who's elderly. No different. I mean, there's difference of cell, how many cells, trillions of cells to whatever cells, but you're still taking a human life. A sperm and an egg alone is not a human life. Together, it's a human life.
Right.
After that, it grows. Let it be, right? But that's why I'm against abortions of convenience, which a lot of young teens do. A lot of women in the African-American community do a lot of these things, really, like 50 million since 1937, 73. And they talk about Black Lives Matter. Talk about Black Lives Matter, but you couldn't. See, so there's all these, and this is because of the feminism and these convenience abortions that you can go in without telling your parents to get an abortion, you know, things like this. There's no consequence. This should be a tragedy. Abortion should be oh, my God, I have to get one because my child has no brain. Oh, my God, you know. It should be a terrible thing. Instead, it's being celebrated. Like, yeah, freedom, liberty. Go get an abortion and feel what it's like. You'll feel so liberated. I've seen a feminist say, nobody knows how great it is to feel. You're crazy. So this is what I'm against. You know, of course, the celebration of such a tragic thing that may have to happen in some cases, like rape. If you're raped, I don't think you should be forced to have a kid. Incest, rape by family. Absolutely not. Degenerate diseases, something like this. Your kid's going to be, you know, born without eyes. I don't know. Those are reasons why I would do it.
Alrighty, we're going to a break and we'll be right back. Alright, we are back. And we were talking about abortion, and I was, during the break, I was thinking about my miracle child. My doctor told me, I was in the hospital 5 times during my pregnancy with my daughter.
Wow.
And the first time that I went in, he said, you really should abort this child. And I just did, I would not do it. I just felt I couldn't, I wouldn't. And, my children are the joy of my life. And I would have missed that. I would have missed the joy of her sweet smile, I am so blessed to have been able to be her mother.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if the doctor just wanted you to do it for some reason.
Well, because he said that I actually did have to have a hysterectomy, 9 months later, but I would have missed the beauty of her life. I did the right thing. Sometimes you have to go with your gut.
Yeah.
You can't take authority figures as gods and say, oh well, gosh, I better do this. I just wouldn't and couldn't and didn't. And I'm grateful every day that I didn't.
Yeah, they're only human, you know, they can make bad decisions too. And then.
Exactly.
That's the problem with authority.
Exactly. What do they know? Who are they? And speaking, let's go back to the jail thing.
Sure.
Okay, Epstein, he divulged all this stuff. Clinton was a frequent flyer on the Lolita Express. Dershowitz was involved. All these people that were involved, they're still running around. What has happened to them? They are guilty of being pedophiles. Filthy pedophiles. And they're still running around, which is flouting the law.
Yeah, that's insane. But that's the world that we are allowing to happen. Because people are so detached from these things. Oh my God, that's terrible. But they have mortgages, they have bills to pay, they have their own problems. So unless it hits home to them personally, most people don't act. But that's why I tell people, you know, as things will get worse, eventually we will have Weimar Republic type conditions where people will have to do something because a loaf of bread will be $100,000. it might take that. Maybe these people have learned not to let it happen that way. I don't know, but I don't think these people, the people in charge or what they're doing, I see that they make the same mistakes over and over again. And
are
I also,
they mistakes or are they just scheduled?
I don't know, but either way, it's also our fault because complacency kills. It's the one thing I learned from the Marine Corps. Complacency kills. If you get complacent in the war zone, you take off your helmet, your rifle's away from you, next thing you know, guy gets in the camp, starts shooting people, you're dead. So complacency kills, and I always remember that. And I look at this relationship we have with these people at the top, and it's a two-way thing. It's a two-way thing. And we allow these people to get away with it. We do. We really do. Because people are afraid to sacrifice, whether it be lose their job or lose their lives for freedom and justice. And our enemies know that. They understand people are that way. But most people are. Right. And they can manipulate it. So you always need a minority of people to get everyone else to be convinced. Look, we have a better deal than these guys. You know, these people are doing this to us. We have to stand up and fight. But that takes, it takes the masses a long time to suffer. They will take a lot of, look at this $600 check. What a slap in the face. Israel gets $500,000. Nepal gets this much money. Pakistan, all this money for all these other countries, but you get $600. That should have been right there, slap in the face. And then, nope, nobody has done anything. So
since 1948, we have subsidized Israel with billions and billions and billions of dollars while they kill and slaughter the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And yet, about the same time that, 1948, you had, the genocide treaty was passed, where supposedly anybody that attacks another ethnic group, they're guilty of genocide, and the UN is supposed to punish or at least say that justice is done so that nobody kills another ethnic group. Right now, they're killing the people in Yemen. They're starving the people in Yemen to death.
Yep.
They're killing the Palestinians, stealing their land.
Yep.
What the heck? Why pass these laws? Are they only good for one ethnic group? What the heck?
Right.
I get really ticked off.
I can tell. No, it's the injustice. And people know the power that that group has in America because America is their, you know, executive branch, if you will. And if America wasn't, they'd have a lot more problems and they wouldn't be able to be so arrogant and cocky in what they're doing. So if America pulled out its support for Israel, they'd be in a lot of trouble. They'd start acting the way they should act. But until we do that, they're not going to change anything. And like I mentioned before, all of our politicians are corrupt. So
right. Yeah, they're all owned and controlled. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they just released Pollard from Jonathan Pollard.
Yeah.
He was just one of dozens, maybe one of a hundred, of hundreds. And no big deal. They've stolen uranium from the country. They've destroyed, cities and areas in Pennsylvania and left the U.S. government and the local government to clean up when they've destroyed land with uranium because they weren't doing something properly. They're criminals. Why the? I just get so upset.
Yep. Well, I mean, I don't mention these people specifically in the book for a reason because I want people to start thinking on their own and concluding what I mean. And it's obvious in the sense that, you know, either way, it's the elite at the top. It doesn't matter what their ethnic group is. It's the actions they take. And once the people identify those actions, they will understand the pattern of who these people are. And again, it's not just that one tribe. It's all the people with them, the Clintons, it could be the Saudis.
Yes.
It's just a parasitical psychopathic elite at the top of the world, which I mentioned, that they're psychopaths running the planet. It's a small minority of people on any population. It's like 1% or something. That's a lot of people. You know, if our country is 320 million people, 1% of that is like 3 million people, something like that, right? That's 300 million psychopaths. That's 3 million psychopaths running around. How likely of them to be all in Congress? All 5%? It's very likely. All the CEOs, all the business people. It's very likely because psychopaths climb the ladder by destroying other people. And they can mimic empathy and manipulate you. So the world's run by psychopaths. I think no one would disagree with that. And that's all the world's leaders mostly. And we need someone who's not a psychopath to stand up, several of them in different countries, to do something about it. But we need the people's support. And that's the biggest hurdle, is to unify the people. And that's why I write my book. You know, we all want to avoid suffering. If only we could work together on that. If only we could work together on eliminating suffering that's not necessary. Right. I write these things because everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to have their families. Everybody wants peace, you know, and people have different methods to get it. Unfortunately, the people in charge have their own wicked ways to do it because they want peace on their own. But, you know, we have to understand, and I talk about these, the predator class, and they don't deserve to live in this world. They don't deserve to live. And in the world I envision, they don't deserve to live.
I agree. You talk also about not arguing with people.
Yeah.
It really doesn't do much good to argue with people. You can share your opinions, and which is what you do, and you do it wonderfully well. And then they can make their own decisions. Yeah. But you're not going to waste your energy trying to convince somebody, because people just aren't convincible if they decide what they want to do.
I remember people telling me, don't join the Marine Corps. And they were telling me why. And I was like, oh, you're just not a patriot. Like, they wouldn't convince me either. So there's a time where you learn on your own. You plant the seed, and then other things will water that seed in the person's experience in life. And they will go, wow, that guy was right. Might take a time. Then maybe they'll never wake up. So now I don't argue with people in the sense that I share my opinion. I share, well, facts usually, not my opinions. And then, you know, if I see the person's, you know, too far out, I don't even bother. There's no reason. I like to speak to fence sitters, people who are in the middle. Well, I think I saw this. What do you think of that? I don't care about arguing with my enemies. Number one, I don't care at all because they want to destroy me. I've learned not to get sucked into the troll arguments. I used to spend time talking to my enemies all the time. Oh, these people are lying. You're lying about me. Why are you saying this and trying to debunk that? They're doing it on purpose. So I focus a lot of my time just talking to people around the fence or trying to help my allies and give them motivation and inspiration to take action in some way, shape, or form. That's where you should put your time. People like yourself who are already with you, focus on building a team, getting your message out there, a unified message, and looking for the fence sitters who are like, there's something wrong with this, so what can we do? That's what you need to look for. Don't argue with people who are too far gone and can't wake up even. There are some people who just can't. They're too invested. They're too far gone, too programmed, and that's just a casualty of war, if you will. You look at it like that. You know, it's like a zombie virus. They got infected. They can't save them. You gotta let them go. So.
There's one place in your book, early on in your book, where you make the statements in bold.
Yes.
It's just terrific. It's you're talking about Rocky.
Rocky Balboa's, one movie scene. You should watch that if you haven't. You can just Google it.
Yes.
It's a beautiful scene. It's one of the best scenes in movie history, in my opinion, when it comes to motivation.
Exactly. Do you want to tell us about it?
Well, I mean, I don't remember everything you said, but I don't have the book on me. I mean, I have it in my living room.
Oh, okay.
But if you want me to grab it, I could definitely read it if you want. Or if you want to read it, you can go ahead.
Whatever you'd like.
Okay.
Grab your book because you can do it with the feeling that you want.
All right, I will.
Yes. Okay. This is really a great scene. It's a great book. It is so full of wisdom. I feel like I know this gentleman. I have so much commonality with him. This is somebody that that is not afraid to be emotional and shed a tear, not afraid to be angry, but would probably not expend his anger energy where it would not be necessary.
I have the book here. All right.
Okay, so page 10. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, page 10. So this is a scene where Rocky Balboa and his son get an argument, and his son's like, you know, Dad, it's hard living in your shadow and blah, 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 and he's making all these excuses why he hasn't exceeded. So Rocky says this to him. He says, let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. Then I bolded this. You, me, or nobody is going to hit hard as life. But it ain't how hard you can get hit. It's about how hard you can get hit. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you could take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you got to be willing to take the hits. And not pointing fingers saying, you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that. I'm always going to love you no matter what. No matter what happens, you're my son, you're my blood. The best thing in my life. But until you start believing in yourself, you ain't going to have a life. And that quote right there, especially in bold, which I screwed up, by the way, sorry, but, you know, it's just something you gotta say. If you Google Rocky Balboa scene with his son, mm-hmm. you'll see the energy Stallone puts in it. It is beautiful.
Yes.
Way better than I wrote it. And that, but that's the thing. It was all about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. That one line has been my life story.
Yes, I
that's
felt
what it
that.
Is. That's
I
what
felt
it is.
That. Mm-hmm.
So when you ask me why am I so sensitive in this book, because I know what people are so, I know what they're going through, and I persevered through it. In fact, I got the tattoo on my arm that says perseverance on my left, to my right bicep on the bottom to remind me to persevere through all this suffering. And again, a lot of my suffering was mental. You know, I'm not deformed. I don't have a, you know, missing leg or, you know, it's not like I've had a bad life with my family. A lot of it has been because of an introvert, my ego torturing me for decades and being lied to is very, again, that's why a lot of people at the end, they don't want to know the truth because it would destroy their entire worldview, their investment, their belief system. You know, I was willing to do that. I was willing to jump through the rabbit holes and there's a price to pay. It's not easy. If it was easy, everyone would know the truth. Everyone, oh yeah, I know the truth. Yeah, sure. No, it's not easy to find the truth, first of all, and then to accept the truth. So that's why, you know, you gotta take the hits. If you wanna know the truth, you wanna know what life's about, you wanna introspectively, do some kind of soul searching and really challenge your ego and tame it, you have to suffer. It's just a spiritual adventure. And there's a lot of spirituality in this book, by the way. It's not religious, but
yes,
it's a lot of spirituality because I do think we're spiritual beings. But
we
don't,
are.
But don't confuse that with religious.
Religion, yeah. Right.
But yes, it's very important that, you know, we go and understand that life is going to be challenging and we have to take these hits and keep moving forward. That line right there really pushed me through a lot of suffering. So that's why I shared it. And it's from a movie. That's why I was like, I don't want to put any quotes in this book. Then I started putting quotes anyway. But that quote, I suggest everyone Google it. You know, Rocky Balboa, and he's talking to his son and you'll see, it's just an incredible thing to watch. A speech to his son. Yeah. So just Google Rocky Balboa's speech to his son, inspirational speech to his son. You'll get it on YouTube or whatever and you'll see it all. It's beautiful. It's about 4 minutes long or whatever, 3 to 4 minutes. And it's just a great scene, probably one of the best scenes I've ever seen in my life in regards to inspiration and not making excuses. So I had to share it. I had to share.
Right. And it was very, appropriate.
Yeah.
Very appropriate and appropriate to your growth.
Yes.
Because while you suffered from PTSD, as a result of your Marine Corps service?
Yep.
How did you seek counseling? Okay, we'll pick this up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back. Alrighty, we are back with our guest, Angelo John Gage. His website is AngeloJohnGage.com. He is the author of a must-read book, From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. And we're talking about PTSD. And before you talk about that, just let me share something from your book. Hatred costs too much. Notice how much more suffering and pain hatred adds to your current challenges. Some of us get sucked in so deeply that it costs us our very souls. The more you allow your anger, jealousy, or whatever other negative emotions drive you into hatred, the more you'll pay. Notice that negative emotions always feel draining. That's because they are. How many of you have felt drained after a moment of joy? Right? When you feel joy, it doesn't drain you. Anyway, tell us about your PTSD and how you managed. Are you there?
I was muted.
My
PTSD came later on. So I got out of the Marine Corps and I was happy, extremely happy to leave. And I went to Italy for like a few weeks to go see my family there and to connect with my cousins and all that. So it was a good vacation. And I signed up for college quickly, get in very quickly. And my first semester, I got a 3.63 GPA. So I was like, oh, this is great. I loved it. I had the discipline. The next semester, 3.83 GPA. And then suddenly I had the urge to quit. Like a month before, I had to get my exam. And I was like, no, I'm done. Then I went back and repeated the same courses with the same teachers saying, listen, I think I have PTSD. I quit because of this. Like, okay, we'll reinstate your grades and everything. Went back, same teachers came the same month in May to do my finals or whatever. I was like, no, this is not for me. Then I did energy consulting. No, this is not for me. Massage therapy. No, this is not for me. Club promoter. No, this is not for me. And eventually I was like, what the hell's wrong with me? So I started to look into this stuff and I realized that my PTSD was coming on later on. You lose passion. You're not motivated. You're depressed. Your moods are up and down. So even though I had a discipline to do work, I didn't care to do it. I lost interest in it. I was very bored. And also I was trying to live my life. You know, I missed out in college and the partying. So I was going to clubs, chasing women, partying, doing drugs, whatever the case, maniac. That didn't help. But eventually I was like, there's something wrong with me. And I started looking into Tony Robbins and I went to go get NLP courses. I actually finished that. So that's the one thing I finished. But my PTSD came later on. My relationships with people were very difficult, like girlfriends and things like that. It was like a buildup over the years. So I've managed by, I do take medication, very low dosages. But I did seek help. And, you know, basically a lot of this internal stuff was something I had to deal with, my ego.
Yes.
So that's what it really came down to.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back and we will take some questions. Be right back.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest is Angelo John Gage. And his website is AngeloJohnGage.com. And he's the author of From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. You really do have a wonderful respect for animals, which I share with you also. I just don't believe there's any animal that would ever hurt me or any skunk that would ever spray me or... I just have a kind of connection to them. And there's something else too. We'll get back to your PTSD, but then after you talk about that, I want you to tell me when you think the country should declare war. That's priceless.
Oh yeah, okay. Oh, you want me to talk about that right now?
Are you done talking about your PTSD?
I'm pretty much. The PTSD, again, it was more mentally than physically. I do have an ankle issue and other things, but the PTSD comes from the trauma. I think prolonged trauma from being in a war zone. At any moment I could die, seeing death. I've seen people get killed in front of me, seeing innocent civilians who are already dead. Traumatizing to someone who's never been to a funeral in his life. I never went to a funeral in my life. So I was 18, and I saw the destruction that our powers can do. I saw the military might against the Iraqis, and it was just horrific. But then coming back and learning it was all a lie, it was also traumatic, and the rest of it, it's just all built up. But my PTSD is more about me forgiving myself for what I've been through, and also just, there's also like a physical part of it too. I have a twitching problem, left side of my body. I don't know where it comes from. No one understands what it is. It just manifests itself in anxiety. So I do have anxiety from it. But yeah, that's why I'm a disabled veteran, you know, and a lot of the guys I know come back not the same, and I help them get the benefits. I help them as much as I could, get all the benefits they could get out of the system, because they deserve it, because, you know, we were lied to, we were hurt for it, and we suffer to this day from it. So nobody goes to war coming back the same. I don't care what they tell you, how tough they are. A lot of guys in Vietnam came back with nothing. They're getting their benefits now. You know, so it's, we got to take care of each other, us veterans.
Right.
I did that. And my friend Michael, who passed away, he was a Marine too. He helped me get my benefits, and I helped my friends get their benefits, because they won't really push for them. They'll give you a little rating here and there and try to blow you away, you know, throw you off. But yeah, you really got to fight for them, because we deserve more. And it's important that we do that. So that's the story of my PTSD. I still have it today. I still have to deal with my bipolar kind of mentality, my depression, my inability to keep focused at times. And then there are times I go too hard. I go too focused, burn myself out. So there's that balance, just accepting even my family, my wife and son, just trying to be normal as a person, because I could be like a robot sometimes, you know. So I got to relearn humanity, if you will, because that's what they do in boot camp. They break you down into a robot.
Boot camp is trauma-based mind control.
Yes, that's essentially, that's book, in of itself is PTSD. But, you know, but the rest of it all combined, yes. And then coming back to civilian life, you don't know what to do with yourself. You've been told how to think for 4 years.
Right.
And now it's like, all right, you're on your own. Good luck. Yeah, you don't know what to do with yourself. So.
And that's something I couldn't deal with when I was there. I just couldn't deal with people telling me what to do, because I felt relatively bright, and I didn't like to be told what to do by somebody that
was
smarter than
exactly.
that I had, you know, 40 points higher IQ than they did.
That's another problem I had. All these people, for like, they were so steel. I'm like, really? This is my staff sergeant? Okay.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, speaking of which, war, you were talking about the section.
Where, yes, I love that. Oh gosh, yeah. Tell us when you, oh.
Well, that, I mentioned Smedley Butler, and he wrote War is a Racket, and he said, the people who should vote on war are the people. The citizens should vote.
You know,
I took it to a step further though. I took it to where the president should not be the commander in chief at all, because he's a civilian, he doesn't know, should be the top general. I took it to where there should be a voting system where the people vote for war, not Congress. Congress only tells the presidents and the generals that we're declaring war, type of thing. Because we don't have that right now. We should have a direct democracy when it comes to war. Direct democracy means literally there should be a system of voting where it's through blockchain technology, where the people vote directly. We wouldn't have wars. That's what would happen. Nobody would want it. And some will argue, well, then the people don't know any better, and they put our country at risk. Please. Please.
Our country's at risk by what's going on now.
Yes. Our country is the risk.
Yes.
But, that's why, Smedley Butler was a good person. He understood, the military industrial complex. And if you take away the presidential war powers and his ability to deploy the Marines anywhere he wants, or launch a Tomahawk missile when he feels like it, that could start a war in of itself. I mean, this is why it's stupid to have this power. He should not have that power, the president, at all. And Congress, you know, they say they haven't declared war in a long time. Some people say they have, whatever. But the point is, they shouldn't have power either. The people should only have power, because they're the ones who are paying the price of war with their taxes, and they're sending their daughters and sons to war. These congressmen aren't. So we should not allow these people to declare war. It should be the people who are paying the ultimate price who declare war. That was that section. And I think nobody would disagree with it, other than the people who are a military industrial complex.
Right. And it's very large. And it's grown over several decades.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I just love that. I thought, oh, that's just really perfect. And the fact that you brought up Smedley Butler.
Yes.
That just clinched it.
It's a small, it's a very quick read, Deanna. It's like 12 pages. You could read
yes.
it. Yes. Having coffee, you could read it. But, yeah.
Okay. I've got so many post-it notes in your book. I should own stock. It's like that. Okay, I was trying to figure out what I practice energy medicine. I was trying to figure out what rhythm you were. There are five different rhythms.
Oh.
And depending on what kinds of things that you experience physically, illnesses is often dependent on what rhythm you are. And I think you're a perfectionist, for one thing.
Certainly,
you probably have lung issues and maybe large intestine issues.
No, I don't have, I don't really get, I'm really healthy actually.
Oh, okay.
Very healthy. I mean, digestive issues, yes. I had some of them and then I stopped eating red meat.
Okay.
I actually went vegetarian. I actually went vegan for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what I mentioned about the animals. It's just horrific what they do to these animals.
Oh, I know.
But I started eating chicken again. The red meat has been an issue. My whole life I've been eating red meat. I kind of got rid of that. Mm-hmm. So now my digestion's better.
Good.
Yeah, so my thing for, it's always been digestion essentially. Going to the bathroom, if you will, has always
yes.
been an issue for me.
Okay.
That's really the only problem. I don't get sick. I never got the flu. I got this COVID thing, whether it's real or not. I don't know. People argue it, but I got something that took me out for a month. Really wow. strange. Didn't get a fever. Didn't get the cough. Well, my father-in-law got the sense of smell, lost the sense of taste. My son got headaches. So we all got the COVID thing, which I think is real in a sense. It's probably a weapon, honestly, just to shut down the economy. But I got it for a month. I was just knocked out. My back was hurting and I was really tired. And
lower back?
The whole back, whole thing. Like I worked out, okay. which makes no sense. But, it was a lethargy I've never experienced before. I'd rather have had the flu, which is 5 to 7 days, you know, but this thing was weird. And I got over it just a few weeks ago and I was like, wow, and I feel better. But, it was, something different, you know, and I know people might not believe there's something out there, but I don't see why the government wouldn't spray or use chemicals or,
okay.
They have before. So
they are spraying as we speak.
So, I mean, they've done experiments like this, Operation Sea Spray, where they let bacteria out in San Francisco. They've injected people with plutonium in hospitals.
Yes.
Didn't tell them. They did the experiments on the African Americans. I don't see why Wuhan Labs wouldn't release the virus or make it on accident. I don't think it's from a bat. I'll put it that way. And the way it's affecting the world, and it affects people differently too. It's very interesting. People get ventilators. Some people are totally fine. It's a very strange thing, whatever this thing is. But I certainly got something, and I'm just saying this because I never get sick. I don't get the flu. I get not for years. I've been healthy. I eat right. But the only problem I've had was digestion from the red meat. I finally learned when I went vegan, and I started incorporating food again just to see. It was always the red meat the whole time.
Oh, the other thing you said, which made a lot of sense to me, you were saying that you were talking about junk food.
Yeah.
And you said something to the effect that people aren't willing to spend money for good food.
Yeah.
That their wealth was more important than their health. And I thought, what a great quote.
Yeah. It's true.
Is that what you said? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. They put their wealth over their health. They rather.
Yes.
They're worried about their money when they're going to spend it on their health anyway when they're sick, when they don't eat.
Right. I thought that was what a beautiful quote that was.
Same thing about mattresses, buying your bed. You should buy a nice bed for yourself. You're going to be on it for 10, 30 years, you know? It's going to be, that's one thing my friend told me. He's like, you know, why are you so cheap in your mattresses, man? You're going to spend a third of your life. I'm like, you know what? You're right. I'm like,
exactly.
So I bought myself a nice bed, you know, a few $1,000, $2,000 something, and it's.
Sure.
Got to, because look, you just divide it by the years, 200 a year or something, right? But people know, I want a cheap bed. Well, now you have back problems and you can't sleep. And, you know.
Right.
So might as well spend, you're going to spend a third of your life sleeping on this thing. You might as well spend the money.
Absolutely.
That's my view too. So that's a mundane entry, right? At the end, it's just a little stupid thing, but.
But it's just.
It's common sense.
But it's important.
Yes. It's common sense too.
Yes. So. We do have a caller. Cool. Let's take Charles in Florida. Charles?
Yeah. How are you doing, Deanna?
Great. And you?
Yeah, fine. Yeah, I had a friend of mine that's now deceased, Gene. He was a veteran of Vietnam. And he was also a you know, counterculture. But he admired Alan Watts a lot. His favorite phrase from Alan Watts was, "They washed nature clean of magic." He always quoted that.
I love Alan Watts. He's so great. And he's very playful. He's very playful, though. He's not like a serious guru. He doesn't really talk. He died of drinking alcohol too much, and that's what happened to him. But he wasn't, like, full of himself. And all of his – you can just listen to Alan Watts on YouTube all day. There's all these motivational speeches and videos, and he really affected me much when it comes to the whole of the universe, like Marcus Aurelius. There were all people who believed the universe is one thing, and it all goes with the flow. And so Alan Watts, he just made it more playful for me. Mm-hmm. It's very serious stuff, but he delivered it in such a great way. Mm-hmm. And I quoted Alan Watts in this book, too. And he basically says something, everyone's trying to be something they're not, or trying to be someone else when all they have to be is themselves, you know. They're not happy enough being themselves. And that's something I've always struggled with, trying to be someone else, trying to emulate somebody when all I have to do is be myself. So Alan Watts really affected me as well, the way he was. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, he always admired Zen and Shintoism and Taoism, you know, the Oriental religions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He knew quite a bit about it. And he had quite a bit to the radio stations in San Francisco, KPFK, I think he had to do with the founding of it. I think the public, I'm not sure. I read his autobiography. I know he was born in England. It may have been, he was.
Ken, what'd you say?
Pardon? Hello?
You mean Alan Watts? Yes, yes, yes.
Pardon?
That's our producer. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay.
No, the producer was just saying Alan Watts did a TV series on that station.
He didn't found KPFK, or I have the name wrong, or it's a famous station in San Francisco.
Right.
Whole network of kind of liberal, progressive network.
Right. Charles, do you have a question for
us? Oh, no, just statement. No question. I had another friend who was a bonus marcher in the 1930s.
That was
up in Washington D.C. when Eisenhower and MacArthur and Patton were riding around on their horses. My friend from Lansing, Michigan, Rex, he was also interested in Oriental religions, but he had joined the army when he was 15 years old in Columbus, New Mexico for the First World War. And he got to meet Smedley Butler, he told me. Smedley Butler was the only one that came to the bonus marchers, you know, when they were camped out there.
Right.
You know, they drove them out of Washington, D.C.
Yes, they did.
Cheap states and the government
buggers
wouldn't even pay them a bonus from World War I.
Exactly.
And he didn't admire Patton. He said he saw him riding around, too, on his horse, just like MacArthur and Eisenhower. It's two, three people he didn't exactly like.
No.
He learned later on what was going on.
Yeah, he learned, and then he had an accident, apparently.
Yes.
Interestingly
enough. Yeah, I know about Patton's, he did, privately, he did a lot of things, but if he'd survived and the OSS had knocked him off, I'm sure he would have been different, but still, what those three did, in 1933, I think it was just before when Herbert Hoover was still in 1932. Yeah.
Yeah. Herbert Hoover was a terrible.
Smedley Butler was the only one that came out to visit the bonus marchers.
Right.
Yeah, that's about what I wanted to say to you, don't have to.
You got to fight for those benefits because they weren't giving them. They weren't giving them out.
Yeah, they were real cheap back then. Congress didn't want to let a dime loose, for veterans.
Yep.
Especially World War I veterans. Make the world safe for democracy.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sure. War to end all wars. Well, yeah. Of course, that is true now. The third, World War number three will be the world war to end all wars.
Yep.
That literally is true.
Let's hope we don't see it, though. Hopefully not.
Oh, thank you.
Smitty Bunker's right,
Yes, war is a racket. And he died in a facility, a government facility. He went in. He was feeling fine. He'd been through World War I. He treated his men so well. He was wonderful. He made sure they had more rations. He made sure that they had a clean camp. He was wonderful with his men. And my grandfather was with him as his aide. But he was wonderful. And then he went into a government facility, and he was gone within 2 weeks. I believe that they eliminated him.
Yes, possible.
Just as they've done other people.
Yep.
Yeah, he died before we got into World War II. Died in 1940. Smedley Butler.
Right. He was going to spill the beans about warfare. That was his whole.
Oh
purpose.
Yeah, yeah. He asked. They asked him to take over the government. To set up some kind of fascist, or he called it or authoritarian state, the big wigs back then, the head of the Los Angeles Times and Morgans and Rockefellers and all them,
they were just trying to get him to do what they wanted. Yeah,
they actually had a TV program about it in the 1950s about Los Angeles. It showed somebody playing Smedley Butler involved in Los Angeles, involved in the people. I can't remember the name of the people that owned the LA Times. Anyway.
I'm not sure. Probably saying
one of the families that were behind it.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your phone call,
Charles. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles.
Take care. Okay, we have Frank in New York. Frank, welcome.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, good evening, everyone.
Hi.
Your guest, I'm sorry I didn't get your guest's name. I have a lot of static on my line. What's his name?
Angelo.
Oh, Angelo, okay.
Yes.
Did you see the film clip that was made about the Blackwater massacre of the 17 people in Iraq?
I know about it. I know that they let the guys off, apparently. The mercenaries, the Blackwater guys.
Another
Trump present, just pardoning these people.
Yeah. Pardon all the criminals, the murderers.
Yeah, and these are guys who are making $120,000 a year while us Marines are making pennies, right, per hour.
Right.
And they just massacre these people, and they're saying, oh, they didn't shoot, but they did shoot. I mean, we'll never know exactly, but I highly doubt civilians are shooting at people for no reason.
Exactly.
So, it's just another tragedy. But yeah, I know the story. I don't know the details exactly, but I do know they got off. And that's terrible. Obviously, it's horrible.
Yeah, they did. Well, a website that is... you know, derided and pilloried from post to post is Democracy Now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it quote unquote left leaning? Which I don't think that should be a negative. It's just something. Just Democracy Now is where they're coming from.
Yeah,
and they did a whole 20-minute section about that, interviews with the family members and so forth. And I couldn't. Look, I'm a tough guy. I was born and raised in Newark.
Yeah.
And I had a hard time dealing with that. The atrocities that happened with these innocent people. They weren't combatants. They were innocent.
Yeah.
So I'm asking, I guess I'm asking you is, in your circle of friends, who do you talk to? Do you talk about things like this?
Yes, I mean, like I said earlier in the show, I thank God I didn't kill anyone. Because if I had killed even an Iraqi soldier, I would have killed an innocent person. I would have killed a freedom fighter. Because technically, we're invading Iraq, we're the bad guys. And if I killed one of them, I would have killed a freedom fighter. I'm the terrorist, I'm the insurgent. So I would have been upset. I did have a friend who was a sniper, who is a sniper, or was. He almost took his own life. Because when I became friends with him a few years ago, he eventually learned the truth from me. Everything, all the truth. And he's like, Angela, I've killed people. I think he killed 15 people.
Oh, he must
and,
be.
Yeah, he's like, I see them in my bed at the end of my bed at night.
Oh.
He's all, but you know, I said to him, Rocco, I said, you didn't know any better, brother. You know, you didn't know any better. It's not your fault. And you know, there were times it was legit. He had to shoot somebody and there were times it could have been a kid with a gun or maybe not a gun. You know, it's just. But he saw his friends explode in front of him. He was a recon sniper, very, very in the trenches. I was a combat engineer. I'm supporting infantry. He was before the infantry. So it's very terrible. But yeah, you know, we talk about this. Yeah, we have a combat action ribbon. My unit got a combat action ribbon, but we weren't in the combat that you would see in the movies. I was a support battalion. So I was in combat zones. I saw bombs explode, people and all that stuff like that. But I wasn't in the front lines. I was behind the front lines, whereas my friend was in the front lines. So he talks to me about what he did, and he's like, man, it just changes you forever, you know? So it's tough, and that's why a lot of these veterans, they need help. That's why they kill themselves. 22 veterans take their lives a day.
Yeah.
Because you don't take people's lives and are not the same person, especially when you come back and there were no weapons of mass destruction, especially when you come back and there is no freedoms you've gained. One guy yesterday on Twitter is like, oh, why are you so anti-patriotic? Don't you want to fight for your friends? I said, what freedom did you gain from any of these wars? In fact, your freedoms have been taken from you with the Patriot Act.
That's right. Yeah, that's, you're absolutely right about that. Well, I think the thing that struck me the most and hit me the hardest was they showed in a piece, they showed the killers, admitted killers, walking to the courthouse back and forth, smiling, smirking and smiling. They seemed to have no sense.
Not all Americans are brainwashed. We're starting to wake up as a country.
But nothing will happen to these guys. They're going to get off, and they're going to go live in the suburbs somewhere.
Yeah.
And they're not going to, they've been pardoned. What happens? Nothing happens to them.
I know. And there's probably more like that. There's probably more you've never heard of before. You know, that's why these whistleblowers like Snowden or whatever, they have to run away from our country because they expose, the one cameraman, that one Iraqi cameraman and his crew were massacred by the helicopter and they were just cameramen. Oh, he has a bazooka. I've seen all that stuff. It's horrible. Yeah. There's always war crimes and war, whether they're intentional or accidental, you know. It's a disgusting thing, war. You know, all hell breaks loose.
And right, but these, go crazy. Remember, these were not
these
military.
Mercenaries.
They were paid mercenaries.
Yes, they're murderers, essentially. That's what they are.
Right.
And the Secretary of Education
is
still there.
Black,
even though her brother, mm-hmm. I mean, how can you expect an urban community to be sane and whole when you have this madness in the suburban white communities? Yeah.
Absolutely. That's why, you know, Newark is tough. How are the cops there, right? They're, I lived in Newark. I lived in Ironbound for 2 years. So I was there. Oh. And, you know, it's a little safer than the other part of Newark, but that's the issue there. There's police stuff that's going on. There's corruption in the police departments. Obviously, you know that. We have a lot of problems with everything. Every institution is corruption at some level. It's because, you know, the people need to unify with each other, regardless of race, regardless of ideas or ideology, and stop the corruption. The corruption infects everything. It's not just, you know, Blackwater. It's even the police departments. It's the medical industry, the media.
Oh, right.
It's everything. Yes. And it's, you know, you can only blame them so much, because we, the people, have to say we're done. We're sick
of
this.
Do you really expect American people, considering and thinking about the present mindset, to really make that really change?
Because they're not suffering enough, you see? The people are well-fed. They can go to Burger King, get a burger right now, go on to Netflix, turn on your app, play a game, you know, go watch pornography for free. There's no reason to revolt, right? Oh, well, this guy got shot. Oh, that sucks. You know, whatever. Pick a person. Oh, police brutality. Yeah, that guy shouldn't have been killed. And they just move on with their life. And the media has desensitized us to these tragedies. Every day it's a tragedy from across the world. Nobody cares anymore. And not that they don't care. They don't have time to care, because then there's another tragedy and then another problem. And then there's this problem with that community and this. And so people are so overwhelmed. Not only with that, mentally, they have mortgages. They're in debt, $200,000 for a student loan they should have never taken out. They have problems with their loved ones. We are bombarded with information, a lot of disinformation, by the way, that we didn't even know what the hell to do. And then we're divided racial, you know, black versus white, male versus female, like I said before in the show. They know what they do. They know how to herd the communities against one another, with race baiting, you name it, the police brutality thing. We all know there's police brutality at some level. We all know that. We all know there's people who are racist. We all know there's people who are evil. And we know there's injustices happening every single day at the highest level of government. It's just that people need to suffer more. I hate to say it, but it's true. People are not at that level because they're not suffering more.
Right. You know? All righty, we are going to take a break, and thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, brother.
Care.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts
with you. Welcome back. Our guest is Angelo John Gage. His website is AngeloJohnGage.com. He is the author of From the Mundane to the Metaphysical. It's a fabulous book. It gets you to thinking very deeply and introspectively, especially if you're that kind of person anyway. I love the book. It's a fabulous book. Okay, we have Kathleen in Texas. Kathleen?
Hey, Deanna, do you go by Angelo?
Yes, Angelo's fine, yeah.
Angelo. Well, sometimes people have shortened it, or anyway.
Yeah, people call me Ange, but, you know, you don't have to call
me Ange.
or Gage.
Well, now that we're best friends.
They call me Gage, too. Oh, Gage is from football and Marine Corps, but anyway. Angelo's fine, whatever you want to call him.
Yes, okay. well... I know you said you were a vet. Now that I know that Deanna was a vet too, I didn't know that, Deanna, till today. Yeah. But my daughter does. She has this business, neurofeedback, mm-hmm. and it's for you know, all kinds of stuff. It's not medical, but it's. They have lots of success with people with PTSD and all kinds of stuff. So once a week she has free appointments for first responders, vets, and everything. So do you want me to give you the website?
Yeah, if you want to, sure. I mean, I've
yeah,
done,
well, you were talking about that. It's kind of a, but anyway, so it's in the pink,
inthepinkwc.com,
and then I think the other one is serenityneurofeedback.com, I believe. But anyway, but the first one for sure I got right, inthepinkwc.com. And so she has a special, she always is wanting to do some kind of benefit for first responders and vets and so on. And so I just thought I would mention that. So the other thing is, did you say that Alan Watts was, is he still alive?
No, he died a while back.
Oh, was, my goodness, I'm shocked, because he used to be on RVN, and and then the owner asked him to change times, and
it's
he said,
different
no, thank
Alan
you.
Watts.
Oh, a different Alan Watts.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you sure, Deanna?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the Alan Watts I used to hear, everybody just loved, and he had an English accent, and
yeah, that's what that. Well, that's Alan Watts that we're talking about, but I don't know how he's on. What network? Oh, really?
They're both English, right?
Wow.
Okay.
Interesting.
But okay, and then. Well, and it's been very interesting, and I love the thing about the words and not having fillers, take a pause rather than say and ah and all that. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, hearing about people going through the unreality of killing other people and, you know, and then coming back and supposed to have a normal life. And then, you know, facing death all the time, firefighters and police officers and, you know, I mean, gosh, you're all in my prayers.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Okay, take care, and thanks, Deanna.
Thank you. All righty, let's take John in California. John, welcome.
Happy New Year, Deanna.
Happy New Fear.
No fear.
Yeah, try not to think about that. It's been a great show. I heard the first part of it, and I had to get off the second. I just came on the last 45 minutes, but you were talking about veterans and some of the things going on and what went on. It's interesting. I was in the Navy during Vietnam, 73 active, and stayed in the reserve another 8 years till 80, and then got out. But it's interesting. Oh, funny thing, quick story. The night before I went to Basic, I watched the movie The DI with Jack Webb. I don't know if you've ever seen it. If you ever could find it, watch it. And he's the ex-Dragnet police. But he played a drill instructor in, I think it was 1950s in Paris Island, South Carolina. It's a great movie. You talk about watching The DI.
That's
interesting. Yeah, Deanna, I didn't know you were in the Marines either, so it's interesting what you were talking about, your experiences. But with today's military, you talk about Marines, and I'm not singling them out, but it seems like recently, you know, you see a lot of ads for recruitment now, especially the Marines. And from you, the Marines for years never had to advertise because, well, at least on TV, because they were always filled their quotas, but when they started not being able to, you started seeing them on TV. First you saw them, you know, guys parading in the parade grounds, and the next thing you know, they're showing in basic training. And then recently you show them, like, you know, they're actually fighting in the middle, it looked like Middle East. I don't know if they're mock-ups or actual pictures they put together, and, you know, firing on buildings and on people and that. Don't see actual people being killed, but, you know, blowing up buildings and all that. And it makes you think about just what it's become like. And, it's too bad, because I had an uncle. He was a lifer, actually a Mustanger, if you know what a Mustanger is in the Marines, from enlisted all the way up to, he was a colonel.
Yeah.
His oldest son was also, during, by the time I was in Vietnam a few years back. But my wife's oldest brother was in the Tet Offensive in the Army, and he went through a lot, and he had some Agent Orange on his lower extremities, and he survived it to this point, but you know, just what he's going through is not, it's not terrible. He's been able to function, but he was in the hospital a couple of months ago with was diagnosed a urinary infection, and I always wonder if there's still some of that Agent Orange bothering him.
Oh, it stays in your body.
Well, they have to, they really screwed over Vietnam vets. They really didn't care about them until recently. Then one of the judges had to fast the cases.
Right.
There's so many backlog. They're like, well, I'm going to pass this. We're going to make these cases fly because a lot of the guys didn't get any help and they didn't get any love either coming back from that place.
Well, interesting, another interesting story. I read through American Free Press. There's a senator from, Illinois, Tammy Duckworth, and she was a veteran. She was a double amputee over in, I think, Iraq or Afghanistan, flying helicopters.
Right.
And you get a feel for that. But then the article was about, you know, what she's been doing to just kind of whitewash all this stuff with the problems with the VA. And you think about what you're going through, and, you know, and then I see these veterans, and the biggest when it's the Wounded Warrior Project, they keep advertising for money on TV, and they, of course they show these vets that really, you know, terrible in their wheelchairs or, you know, they're mentally, you know, which what it's done to them, you feel for them. And then I think to myself, you know, if I saw them walk, I'm, you know, thankful for what you did, but I'm really sorry they put you in harm's way and what happened to you.
Yeah.
You always think about what reaction you might get from, well, them or even the families, you know, if they said, yeah, or they said, oh, no, he did his thing, then you're wondering, well, you know, then why? Did you deserve that if you felt I went over there to blow people up to save America? I wouldn't want to say that to somebody, but you think about that sometimes. How do these people really felt going over there? And then here's what happened to you. Well, you got what you deserved. I don't know if you remember the movie, too. Was it Sniper?
Mm-hmm.
Years back, that he was over in Iraq, and then he came back, and then he was killed by another veteran. He had a mental problem or something. And it's, you know, it's really sad what it's become in the military. And I know the Army Rangers, you don't hear about it anymore. I think since they had that debacle in this Mogadishu, Somalia, where they killed those guys, they were left behind, and all you hear about now are the SEALs.
Right. Yeah, I was saying, a lot of this military is now political now. You know, it's not the same, and then there's so many lies about these wars. A lot of the guys, they just can't handle it. They off themselves 22 a day. It's very sad. That's why I try to avoid a war at all costs. Because it just affects more than the person in war. It affects the country, affects their families, affects the wives and husbands who lose their lovers, it's the children. I mean, how many generations in Iraq have deformities because of depleted uranium that we used? You know, it's just, this is the worst thing that mankind does is war. And that's something what we have to all work together to avoid. And like you mentioned, what they're doing now, the promoting the war in movies, whether it be in commercials, making it glorified. Because I joined the Marine Corps because it was the baddest thing, right? The coolest uniforms. Oh, I'm going to be a sniper. I want to be all, I had all these little, you know, maniac G.I. Joe dreams in my head to be something cool. That's why the Marine Corps stuck me in. I want to be part of the baddest branch and do all this. And they made me a combat engineer. That's all they did. But yeah, I mean, I tell people who want to join, don't join. Don't join anything. If you have to join a branch, go join the Coast Guard or something. Go stop drug dealers or something like that. Do not go overseas. You know, avoid signing up for these bankers' wars. That's what I tell people.
And the last thing I forgot to mention, my youngest stepdaughter, well, my wife's youngest daughter, she was a Naval Academy graduate. She ended up a pilot. She flew helicopters in the Far East for the first turn, and she went over flying fixed wing over Bahrain, ended up in and out of that part of the Middle East. Some of it might have been secret. I don't know. Don't talk about it. But I said, well, at least, you know, if anything, you'd be proud of the fact you did graduate the academy. Now, you're not serving your country going over there. Now, if you want to defend it here, if somebody attacked, fine. But
that's what you don't know. When people tell me, thank you for your service, when people say thanks for your service, I go, you know, I just kind of like, I'm not going to argue with them. You know, they're saying, my father was the one who got me out of this depression. He said, Angelo, you didn't know what you were doing. Because once I learned the truth, I was like, oh, my God, I fought for Zog. Oh, my God. You know, what have I done? He's like, Angelo, you didn't know any better. You didn't know what you were doing. Your intention was good. So you have to work with that. And a lot of the guys don't, none of the guys know the truth. I highly doubt any troop or pilot or anyone is like, I know. I'm going to go work for the banks in the New World Order. No, they don't know that. They're duped just like I was when I was 18 or 17. And then you go in and try to be a patriot. That's why they got all these movies. That's why they make it all hardcore looking, because you want to be a man. And you want to, that's why they give us medals, right? Now, here's a medal for something, you know. It's all ego driven. And, you know, that's why they use people who are willing to sacrifice their lives for a greater good. Unfortunately, it's for a greater evil. They just don't know it. And that's why it's our job, for those of us who know the truth, it's our job to wake up as many people so they do know the truth, so we can prevent these wars. And I think the reason why we didn't go into Syria was because people were sick of the Iraq war and what happened. So that kind of helped. And I think if we keep doing this, we can avoid war with Iran. That's why I'm doing a lot of activism with people in Iran, to not go to war with Iran at all costs.
Oh, so. And that's what they're promoting. They're pushing. They're just pushing.
Yep.
It's really the last country in the Middle East that they haven't attacked. And Trump, in April, right after he became president, he did bomb Syria.
Yes, and that's why I left.
In April.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Don't watch TV. That's the first thing. I haven't had my gun for a long time.
I was talking to Thomas Goodrich. I don't know if it was on your show, Deanna, or maybe Rick Adams in the past. We were talking about some of his books on, like, going back to World War II and some of the atrocities we did, like, you know, the firebombing. I said, wouldn't it be great if you could find if their pilots still alive and write about it? They would talk about their experience. How did they feel doing things like this, or guys going down that actually claimed they were machine gunning survivors, trying to, you know, if they would talk about that, would you see what was in their mindset if they still remember that? Anyway, well, thank you very much, Angelo, and I'll definitely, if I remember the book's name of the book again, I'll try to look that up.
It's
right,
good, Angelo. Yeah, just go there. You'll see my book, and you'll look at that, and you can get paperback, or you can get a Kindle version. It's up to you, whatever you like. But yeah, I think you would really enjoy the book. So I appreciate
it. Thank you. Absolutely, you would.
Right, thank you.
Thank you very much. God bless you both.
Thank you. Take care, John. All righty. We have Tom in Utah.
Hi, Deanna, and I forgot your name, the gentleman's
Angelo.
On with you.
It's okay.
Angelo.
My father's name Thomas, actually. My father's name Thomas, so Tom.
Okay, he has to pay a finder's fee.
Yes,
oh, wait a minute. Yeah. I'm 80, so I probably, I'm older than he.
Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, I got a little diverted while the program's been going, so I don't know if you hit an issue which I have told my students about using the and, you know, the filler words when you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, instead of doing that, use that space to not only think, but also to hear the response of your listener.
True. That's a good point. Yes. Yep. Feel the room out too. Get the body language from the audience as well. Yeah.
Right, and that way you can tell whether they're understanding you, and that also that pause, and I think you did mention that, gives them a chance to not only, you know, it gives them a chance to think about what you said to them and see if they understand it before they go on. Yes. That gives them an opportunity, you know, like you say, with the body language or any verbal reactions to them, you can respond and correct whatever they don't understand.
Yep. Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, the only other thing I could add is I was a instructor for hundreds of young men that went into Vietnam. I was called, well, not that I was called, but I responded, like you say, to the propaganda, and I thought that the Vietnam War was a legitimate, vital, you know, opportunity of combat or correction, police action, as they called it, right?
Yes.
It wasn't until I got into the middle of that mess that I realized it was all poppycock and had nothing to do with freeing the people of communism, simply to protect the investment of the American investors that had bought into the agricultural production of Vietnam. And I lost about 32 of the young men that I taught in that whole thing. And so when I came back, I was very bitter. Of course, I wasn't vocal about it, and thankfully I hadn't, killed anybody while I was there. So I didn't have to deal with that pain, but I realized or understood the pain of the man that I had prepared to go there and kill.
Yes.
And this may sound a little bit fanatical, but I've decided to become as harmless as possible against all of creation. And by the way, the benefits are far beyond what you can imagine. When you stop harming anything, you don't even have to deal with the diseases, whether they're mental or physical.
Right.
So there is literally an opportunity for blessings beyond your comprehension when you cease to bring harm to anything. I worked initially in veterinary pathology and human pathology, so I even understand the horror that occurs in the slaughterhouse as well as in the abortion clinic.
Mm-hmm. I write about the slaughterhouses and what they do to these animals is just horrific. The way they inject them with chemicals and hormones and make them larger than they should be, where the chicken's legs snap and the cow's. I was doing veganism toward the end of the book. I was like, I was going to go vegan. So I wanted to put the argument out there for both groups, but I made it more veganism is more moral. If you accept that life, less death is more superior, then veganism is a more moral diet. Can it be done? That's another question. On a world scale, can it be done? That's another question. But, during the writing of this book towards the end, I was practicing veganism and I was, I kind of was biased on that, but it's still true though. If you accept that less suffering is better, then veganism is the morally superior diet, in regards to that.
Right.
And can anyone do that? Could everyone do it? Maybe not. Maybe it's not the best thing for humans, but you know, I went down that path. It was beautiful to not eat anything of flesh of any animals, but at the end of the day, there's still death no matter what we do on this planet, whether it be pests, whether it be insects. So I stay away from the most, cows. The more sentient a being is, I try not to do it, you know? So I do chickens. I know chickens are like dinosaurs, basically. But what you're doing, basically, is kind of like Jainism, right, where you don't hurt any animals. And I write in my book, there was a worm I came across in the hot sun. And I walked by him. I said, wow, nature is just brutal. Then I said to myself, I could stop this. And I turned around and put that worm under a bush. And it's such a mundane story, but it's true. And I wrote it down in the book, and it was trying to show people that nature is brutal, but we can do what we can as human beings. And I say in the book also, first you must do no harm yourself in this world.
Yeah, nature gives us an opportunity to exercise our empathy.
Yes, exactly.
And we should do that, and it transmits into our relationship with each other.
Yes, yes.
Plus, on the side, since pathology has been my professional experience, there is no disease that's transmitted to you through a vegetable or a fruit. There's none. All of it has to be within the blood, flesh, and fat of a creature. So there's a side benefit of being empathetic with nature. You don't have to deal with disease. That's the side benefit. But anyway, I appreciate your message, and I do have I've been doing battle for people saving babies since I had my epiphany. It is a costly battle, but it's well worth it. If you get a chance, look at a website I have up called lifesave.org or gassingamerica.com. I exposed the poisoning of 34 million, especially babies are the victims. I appreciate what you've done, and Deanna, too. Deanna kind of runs away from me because she knows how fanatic I am. how strict I am.
I'm
okay.
That's all good. It's divine to be like that. It's the discipline that makes you separate.
Yeah, and it won't hurt us. Yeah. It doesn't hurt to be vegan at all.
Yeah.
It does not hurt.
Nope.
Anyway, like I say, I teach my students, and I've taught in 32 universities, believe it or not. And I tell them, when you feel like you need to pause, don't say, or you know. They're very disruptive, aren't they?
Yeah.
So just go to silence, think about it, let your listener think, and you'll both benefit.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyway, Deanna, and thank you. Angel.
Angel. Yeah, it translates to angel, but it's angel. Yes, thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, you'll have a Spaniel.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
But Latin, too. Latin is a terrible language. It's the language of the liars.
Yeah.
Doctors and lawyers.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Take care.
That story about the worm, that was so touching to me. that you would do that, that really touched my heart.
Yeah.
Because it showed how humane and kind that you are. I think that was probably one of the things in the book that was so touching.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I remember it clear as day when I did that. It was just, wow, I could stop this suffering. For a measly worm who probably didn't even feel it.
It's okay.
But I could do it, so why not do it for the worm? And I do it to this day with spiders or anything that I used to smash when I was a kid. Just anything in the house that won't kill us, I put it outside and say good luck.
Good for you.
Good luck, Mr. Spider.
did you ever hear of the starfish about this person was going along the beach and picking up starfish and throwing them back into the ocean?
Yeah, I heard about that.
Right. And somebody says, why are you doing that? It doesn't matter. It's not going to make a difference. And he said, it makes a difference to the starfishes that I threw back. And you're the hero. Thank you so much, Angelo, for being on the program. And bless your heart for doing this book.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you letting me come here to talk about it.
Thank you. Thank you. Bless your heart.
Thank you.
All righty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you next week.